This is LOA Today, the Law of Attraction Show. Welcome to LOA Today. I'm Walt Thiessen. Today is Thursday, October 15, 2015. And last week we replayed a show from December 2012 that I recorded with Bob Berg to talk about his book, The Go-Giver. 1 year later, he released a new book called Adversaries into Allies, Master the Art of Ultimate Influence. And this week, we replay that show from December 2013. With me today is an old friend, somebody who was on the show last year. Bob Berg is back to talk about a new book, his latest book in his series of highly successful books. I presume this one's going to be successful. The other four have been very, very successful. And it's a little bit of a different topic this time. The book is called Adversaries into Allies, Win People Over Without Manipulation or Coercion. In fact, I found it to be a very interesting read. In fact, I would say that this is the kind of read that, regardless of what field you're in, this is one you want to read. It's not something that's necessarily sales-related or anything like that. It's people-related. And let's be honest, what field does anyone live in, except perhaps maybe a computer programmer, where they don't have to deal with people? So, Bob Berg, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Walt. Always great to be with you.
And last time we talked, we were talking about your I guess we call it your flagship book, the Go-Giver, and that's been really the one that I guess launched you to your level of fame that you're at now. But again, this one, Adversary into Allies, this is kind of a little bit of a different direction for you. What made you decide to go this way?
Well, I think people are more and more understanding that people skills are such a huge part of success in anything, whether we're talking about business or personal, and in all areas of life, as you said earlier. I think you can have pretty much all the positive success skills working for you. You can be very talented and of extremely high character. You can be ambitious, kind, charitable, hardworking, energetic, thrifty, what have you. You can have a knack for numbers and a head for business. You can be even-tempered. You can be creative and much, much more. And all that's great, of course. It's terrific.
Oh, sure.
However, unless you can influence others, move people to the desired and appropriate action, achieving any kind of really significant success is more unlikely, if you will. On the other hand, when combining benevolent intent and a learned skill set, you can find yourself constantly, consistently, and really even predictably attaining both personal and business satisfaction while adding exceptional value to everyone whose lives you touch. And I call this ultimate influence, the ability to get the results you want when dealing with others, but in such a way that you make them feel genuinely good about themselves, about the situation, and about you. And the people who can do this, Walt, these are the people who attain huge success.
Yeah, that does make sense. And just to clarify, I'm pretty sure what you're not saying here is this is not about changing people's minds, because ultimately we can only change our own minds. This is about influencing people. That's a different kettle of fish, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, if you were going to change their mind and have them do something that they wouldn't normally do or shouldn't do or wouldn't want to do, that's wrong. That's manipulation. But when you can align your goals with their goals, Zig Ziglar once said, and I thought this was one of the many very brilliant things he said. He said, people don't change their minds. They make new decisions based on new information.
Oh, that's good. I like that.
Yeah. And that's much more than a play on words. It's very, very true. Because, we don't change our minds. But, when we are open to new information, now we've just created a context where we can adjust because we have new information that makes that available. Now, we cannot depend on others to just have open minds, because as human beings, we don't necessarily always have open minds. So we need to be able to elicit that open mind. And that's really one of the things we're able to do by understanding the five principles of ultimate influence, because it helps us to understand how and why people think the way we do.
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice if we really could always count on people having an open mind and make life a whole lot easier? But that's not the way it is.
Right, that's not the way it is. So you make a good point, Walt, because what a successful person does is they don't look at the world as they'd like it to be, They look at it as it is. Now, I ask people not to confuse that sentence. I don't mean we shouldn't try to be, make differences and make the world a better place. And no, of course we should, and we can do that.
Sure.
What I mean is there are, just like the laws of attraction, I mean, there are certain things that are. We can either deny it or we can tap into it, but we can't change it. And so it's the same with the human mind, the way a human being is built to work. There are certain universal laws, certain things we need to understand. And we may or may not think it's good, right, fair, whatever. It doesn't matter. Certain things just are. And we can either embrace that or we can, deny it, but we're not going to change it. And so a successful person sees it as it is and works within that context.
Now, as you so often do with your other books, and as you mentioned just a moment ago, you've broken this concept down into five principles. Why don't you outline for our audience what those five principles are?
Sure. The five principles themselves are number one, control your own emotions. Number two, understand the clash of belief systems. Number three, acknowledge their ego. Number four, set the proper frame. And number five, communicate with tact and empathy.
I almost want to take them out of the order that you present them, but I won't because I'll go through them methodically.
Mm-hmm.
So start with control your own emotions. Now, that is actually a challenge for many people, and I can see why you would include that one in the list. But why include it first? Why does controlling your emotion have to be the first thing?
Because it's where it all begins. Yeah, unless you can control your own emotions, unless you are the boss of yourself, you're not in a position to be able to take a potential negative situation or a negative person or what have you and be able to turn that into a win for all involved. The sages said, who is mighty? One who can control their own emotions and make of an enemy or potential enemy a friend. As human beings, we're emotional creatures. We like to think of ourselves as logical, and to a certain point we are, but we're very emotion driven. And this is fine. First of all, emotions are a great thing. There's nothing wrong with emotions.
Sure.
But we need to be in control of them rather than they controlling us. I love what one of my great mentors, Dondi Scamacci, says, by all means, take your emotions along for the ride, but make sure you are driving the car.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, bringing up Zig Ziglar, I love what he used to say. It's the difference between responding and reacting.
Yeah.
When we react, we're allowing another person, outside circumstance or person to control us. When we respond, we're in control of ourselves and are in a much more beneficial position to act accordingly. I love what he used to say. Did you respond well to the medication or did you have a bad reaction?
Yeah.
So the first thing we need to do, Walt, is retrain our brain to go into be in response mode rather than react mode. So whenever someone says something, remember, people can't make you mad, they can't make you angry, they can't make you sad, they can't make you feel. No, what they can do, though, is they can push our buttons, intentionally or even unintentionally.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, then it's us, it's we, who make ourselves mad or sad or angry or depressed or what have you. So we need to be aware of this, and we need to retrain ourselves that when this potentially difficult situation happens, rather than going into, again, reaction mode, we go into response mode. This is where it all begins. Without this, nothing else is going to matter.
And it's funny that even before I started to read your latest book here, I had been noticing very much in life how much emotion drives everything, particularly in terms of life's storylines.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I guess I had focused on and was beginning to appreciate emotionally, really, is the fact that If you look anywhere around in life, whoever tells the best stories wins.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true for almost any path of life you can think of. It's true in sports. It's true in entertainment. It's true in sales. It's true in work life. It's true in play. It's true everywhere. Whoever tells the best stories is the one who gets the most attention. They get the most interest, and they're the ones that people get behind.
Well, stories connect, and they connect on an emotional level. And again, we take action emotionally. When you practice law of attraction, again, I'm certainly not an expert in that field, you are, but I know just from the amount I've read that when you can have a certain desire and you put emotion to that desire, your chances of attaining what you want. You know, you've obviously raised the vibrations and you're putting out that attraction to whatever it is that you desire. Well, that's when we're controlling our emotions when we do that. So again, there's nothing wrong with them. Emotions are a great thing, great part of life. It's just that we need to be in control of them, not they in control of us.
In fact, I just realized you achieved your success through the Go-Giver by telling a story.
Sure, well, with the help of the great John David Mann, who was the you know the great storyteller. Sure, but I was smart enough to know that that when you want to do that, when you want to tell a story, you team up with a great storyteller.
Yeah. That boy, isn't that really important? I mean, I've noticed in my own life just recently how much I need to work on my own storytelling skills. Because it is a skill. It's not something that you just get handed. It's something that you develop. And there are very few people who actually take the time to develop it. But, Okay, so the second principle is understanding the clash of belief systems. And I can see right off the top why that one's important. But go into that one for a moment.
Sure. Well, what is a belief? A belief is simply it's a subjective truth. It's the truth as you understand the truth to be, which may or may not be the truth.
Right.
And,
yep.
Our belief systems are a combination of upbringing, environment, schooling, news media, television, movies, popular entertainment, popular culture, cultural mores, everything we touch, taste, see, smell, hear, what have you. Now so it's everything that touches our lives that forms our beliefs. However, our beliefs are generally formed and set at a very, very young age, more in the toddler or just post-toddler age. And so what happens is we basically grow up and have our lives run by a set of beliefs that we're not even aware we have. We are basically run by an operating system of which we're not even conscious.
And we're not just talking about political beliefs or religious beliefs. We're talking about a wider range than that.
Everything, the way we see the world, our model of the world, from relationships to money to politics to everything. And so you think about it, it's kind of scary, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's amazing how much we're governed and controlled by something that happened very early in our lives.
Well, and we're not even aware of it.
And not aware of it, yeah.
And this is also why, as human beings, and this is so important for people to understand, we make decisions, including major decisions, based on very limited information. This is because what happens is our belief systems fill in the blanks.
Right.
So, when we feel we need to know something, we fill in the blanks according to our belief system. So, I'll tell you how powerful it is. It's like when you hear someone say, "Oh, everybody feels this way."
Yeah.
Nobody likes that, or everybody loves that, or have you ever, said to yourself, "Well, I would never say that, or I would never do that to anyone."
How many times have we said those phrases, man?
Me too, of course.
Yeah.
This was a big part of really my misery when I was, until I discovered this, until I learned about it from others, because I expected everybody to see. We think that other people think as we think, and they don't. They don't see the world the way we see it. Now, let's add something on top of this. Not only are we governed and run by an operating system, a belief system we don't even know we have, so is this other person with whom we're about to have this difficult interaction. So you've got two people, each of whom don't even know they're run by belief systems. Again, each one thinks the other person sees the world as they see the world. And so this, as you can imagine, is what sets up the context for a clash of belief systems. So in order to work within this, it's not that we have to understand the other person's belief system. We can't. We probably don't even understand our own belief system, okay? But what we do need to do is be aware that they are operating out of a different system. They see the world probably much differently than we see the world. And it's only when we understand that now we've created an environment where we can work within that for a mutually beneficial situation and outcome.
Right. And not only do we not become aware most of the time of how these belief systems are governing us and controlling us and influencing us, but the fact is that we could be completely unaware that there is a clash of belief systems. We may just assume that, well, the other person's just plain wrong. They must be crazy or something, or perhaps we think that they're out to get us or something.
Exactly. We're filling in the blanks. based on very limited information. Yep.
And filling in the blanks is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, that's how a lot of advances take place. People are able, that's one of the things that makes us people. We're able to take limited amounts of information and leap forward to truths that would otherwise take, you know, generations for us to get to. Of course, we have to test them once we get there, make sure we're on the right track. But nevertheless, that can be a good thing.
And just like emotions, you know, belief systems in and of themselves aren't bad.
That's right.
It's when we don't understand where we're being run by them. So, sure, you know, and remember, back in the cave person days, our ancestors had to make these major decisions based on information that had to be the same every single time. I mean, when they're out trying to get their sustenance every day, they had to know if the sound they heard today signaled a potential dinner or a potential diner. Okay, and they had to know that it was going to be the same every single time, or it was literally life and death to them.
Yes.
So yeah, it's not that filling in the if we didn't fill in the blanks, we wouldn't be able to take a step without having to consider, you know, everything in the next step. No, there's times our belief systems absolutely serve us, but not usually. There's a lot more that kind of don't serve us because we walk through life unconscious and unthinking of the fact that we're really not in charge of our own decisions.
And that's really the difference, knowing which ones serve us and which ones
exactly,
don't.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the challenge, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
Yep, absolutely. Which, of course, kind of leads into the third point. Now, very often when we think about our own belief systems, we're going to think about us, about our situation in life, our ego, and so forth. But the third principle actually reminds us that there's another player in this.
Well, yes, because we talk about principle number three being acknowledge the other person's ego. Well, we certainly have to acknowledge ours first. That's key. Now, the ego itself isn't a bad thing. The ego is simply the I.
Right.
It's literally that sense of ourselves that understands and realizes we're a unique human being separate from everyone else. And, you know, that can sound a little politically incorrect in today's world because
yeah.
We hear so much about, you know, oh, we're all one thing. And you know, hey, and let's face it, in Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich, he talked about the mastermind, the universal consciousness. And,
yeah.
And we know from quantum physics that there's the great, you know, plane, really, that there is that electronic field. And you know, the atoms all being connected. And I personally believe that's probably true, and yet that doesn't conflict in any way, shape, or form with the fact that as human beings in our earthly existence, we also operate as individuals.
Mm-hmm.
and that's a fine thing. We all value happiness in our own way, and we have, you know, in the U.S. at least theoretically, we have the right to pursue happiness however we deem appropriate as individuals, providing we don't infringe upon the rights of anyone else to do the same. So there's nothing wrong with that. And the ego is what really, you know, can help us when it's controlled and harnessed. It can help us accomplish great things in our pursuit of happiness, which also helps helps society as a whole. And that's fine. The challenge is when we're not in control of our ego, that very powerful mechanism. When our ego controls us, as so often happens, now counterproductive things happen.
Yeah.
Ego is what has turned adversaries into dictators.
Right.
Not adversaries, advocates. Into dictators. People get too full of themselves. They think they are it. So, you know, so here's the thing.
People think they're it. Oh, no, that never happens, does it?
Right, no, never happens. And so we obviously have to acknowledge our own belief system, I mean, our own ego. But we also have to acknowledge the other person's ego. Now, when I say acknowledge, I certainly don't mean saying to that person, hey, buddy, you know, your ego is getting out of check there. That would have the opposite effect, of course. But what I mean is we need to acknowledge that if this person is acting in a way that is emotion-based, that is unconscious, that is in any way counterproductive to really to everyone's happiness, they are most likely being controlled right now by their ego. And when that's the case, that is how they're going to act. So unless we acknowledge that and then work within that, we're not in a position to be helpful and to have a good outcome. So we must acknowledge that in any interpersonal situation where that person is not acting in a productive way, most likely their ego has come into play, and we need to respect that and honor that.
Makes sense. Now, the fourth principle you outline is one that when you first read it, it doesn't quite make sense. You have to be thinking about the context of what you bring it in. So why don't you describe for people, what is the fourth principle and tell us about it?
Yeah, principle number four is to set the proper frame. What is a frame? Well, a frame is simply the foundation from which everything else takes place. As a quick example, I was in I talk about this in Adversaries and Two Allies. I was in a Dunkin' Donuts restaurant, Dunkin' Donuts store, and there was a little boy, probably 2 years old, maybe a little bit older, and he was walking around the store, and his parents called him over, so he was walking toward his parents. And all of a sudden, he took a spill on the floor. He fell to the floor. Now, he didn't fall very hard, and he didn't hurt himself, but you could tell from the expression on his face that he intuitively knew that wasn't supposed to happen.
Right.
And he looked at his mom and dad for their interpretation of the event. Now,
right.
What happened happened.
Right.
What he was looking for. What does this mean? Okay, how does this affect my world? So he looked at his mom and dad, and I truly believe that had mom and dad, panicked and gone, oh no, oh my poor baby, oh you must be so hurt, oh are you all right? He probably would have gotten upset and started crying.
Right.
But what they did is they handled it just beautifully. They smiled and they clapped and they laughed and they said, oh that was such a good trick, And he immediately started to smile and giggle and laugh, and you know, everything was fine. What they did, what his parents did, was they set a positive frame for him. They set a positive environment. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really what it's about. That's what a frame is. Now, we can easily set a frame by having a genuine smile and a hello in our body language. It shows friendliness and that we want to be allies, and that's fine. That's not particularly difficult. The trick is resetting someone else's frame when they come into it not in a good frame, you know what I'm saying, in a negative frame.
Right,
they
right.
come in, they're having a bad day, or they're angry, or they're a person who's a win-lose type of person, and they want to, right?
Yeah.
And so I'll give you another one that I shared in the story, in the book rather, was when I was pulling into the parking lot of a local hotel, and I was pulling into the parking space, and I wasn't paying attention as I should have been, and I nearly clipped a guy as he was getting out the driver's side of his car. Now, I stopped in plenty of time, but he was certainly startled and so
right.
forth. And he shot me back a really nasty, really angry look. And he always reminded me of that saying, if looks could kill,
right.
I'd be a
right.
dead man.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, first of all, he reacted rather than responded. But hey, you know, you can't blame him. That's what...
That, his car got hit. What do you want?
Yeah, he almost got hit, you know. And so his frame was obviously an anger frame. He said it unconsciously, but that's what it was. Now,
right.
had I bought into that frame, right, it would have only spiraled from there.
Mm-hmm.
I might have said, what are you looking at? And he just said, rah, 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 and I said, rah, rah, you're right. And the egos would have gotten involved in the blit, you know, in the whole thing.
Right.
And at best, it would have been uncomfortable. At worst, it could have been a very nasty situation. So,
sure.
So the first thing I did is I responded, and rather than buy into his frame, I reset the frame, and I simply put an apologetic smile on my face. I raised my hand in the air in a waving motion, and I just mouthed the words, sorry. And immediately he said back, no problem. And that was it. So, you know, so what I did, fortunately, was I was able to reset his frame. And so, you know, this is what we need to do. But again, this takes place because of what? Awareness and consciousness, not buying into emotion, not letting emotion control us, not letting belief systems just run amok, putting a check on the ego, acknowledging both ours and theirs, and making sure that we set the frame. I often say that in any interpersonal, in any potentially difficult interpersonal situation, a frame will be set. The only question is, who's going to set it, you or the other person? If you allow them to set the frame, you're depending on luck, that this person understands what a frame is and or is naturally going to set a good one, which isn't always the case. Mm-hmm. When you take responsibility to set the frame, you can almost be assured of that positive outcome.
I think we could also perhaps say that there's a third possibility, which is that nobody consciously sets the frame. It gets set unconsciously, which is probably the worst situation.
Well, when they are, they usually are set unconsciously, and that's why.
If we're both doing it unconsciously.
Oh, if we're both, of course. Yeah, that's usually what it is. And that's why one of the things that people will have a distinct advantage of after they read this book, because after the first five principles, it really takes up just one chapter. All I do is tell stories in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And these stories are very short. Every chapter is a short story, sometimes half a page and sometimes a couple of pages. But the thing is, I want people to be able to put themselves in these stories. And most of these stories are things that have either happened to you, or not you personally, but to the, you know, you or the reader or me or what have you, could happen anytime or probably will happen at some time. And I want the reader to be able to know how to handle it, because the other person probably, as you just said, isn't going to be conscious of it.
Right.
As long as we're conscious of it and we're equipped to know how to handle it, wow, you know, the reader of the book comes away as that master of people skills, and people think, well, they just have a knack. Well, it's not just a knack. It's actually a set of learned skills.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, it's a knack, not for most of us.
Well, I think I've kind of developed the knack over the years, but it's learned. I mean, I can't say that it was inherited or in any way or something that I was just born with. I had to learn how to do to the limited extent that I can do it. So, yeah.
As a law of attraction expert that you are too, you're tuned in to desiring certain results.
That's true. That helps.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, that helps a lot, no doubt about it. I mentioned earlier how I almost wanted to take these five principles out of order, and this is the one I wanted to go with first. I can clearly see now why you have to have it in the order that you put it in, because it makes a lot more sense that way. But for me, that's the one that jumped out at me when I first started reading the book and was reading through the explanation of it, because, man, oh, man, that frame happens so quickly. In any conversation, it's just there. You don't. It's not like you even have any time. You have to deal with it right now, instantly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I thought I had to go first. But you're right. You have to control the emotions first. You have to understand that there's a clash of belief systems going on first. You have to acknowledge their ego first, and then you can set the proper frame. You can't do that until you do the first three steps.
And that's why I did put them in that order. And the interesting thing is, without those, you can have those other four, and you can do those other four beautifully, but if you don't communicate with tact and empathy, it's not going to make a difference. So in the same way that you have to have those first four before the tact and empathy comes into play, without the tact and empathy, even the other four aren't going to matter.
Yeah, that's true. And that, of course, is the fifth principle, communicate with tact and empathy.
Right.
And in fact, that's why I like that fourth principle so much, because once you have that fourth principle set, the fifth one comes in naturally.
Yes.
When you don't have that fourth one set, that's when it becomes really difficult to be empathetic, to be tactful.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. One of my favorite books of all time was written by Les Giblin about 60, 70 years ago, called How to Have Confidence and Power in Dealing with People.
Mm-hmm.
And Les wrote that what counts is attaining satisfaction without trampling upon the egos of those you deal with. Interesting how the fifth one relates to the third one about acknowledging the other person's ego and honoring that ego.
Right.
He defined human relations as the science of getting what you want while leaving the other person's ego intact. And I thought that was just so clever. And so how do you do that? Again, after you've responded, understanding the belief systems, acknowledging that other person's ego, setting the frame, how do you really leave that other person's ego intact? And that's where I think the word tact comes into play. My dad has always defined tact as the language of strength. And I believe that's so very profound, not just because it's my daddy who said it.
Although that's a good reason.
That's a good reason, though, yeah. I see tact, Walt, as a way of being able to correct someone, if you will, critique, dare I again be a bit politically incorrect and say constructively criticize? Not that we ever want to do any of these things, but again, we're talking about the real world, not making believe it's some pretend world that we'd like it to be. And there are times we need to be able to teach in a gentle way that allows people to not only not be defensive, but to be open to our ideas and suggestions. You know, a person at the company overpays on a negotiable product, or they give some incorrect information to a customer, or maybe someone at the office or someone at home or in a social group is speaking disrespectfully to people. And we need to be able to teach, but we need to do it in such a way that that person's going to be open to it rather than defensive.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's really what now empathy sort of allows us to do this, because what is empathy? Well, empathy is the identification with or vicarious experiencing of the emotions of another person. You know, we go now back to emotions, that very first thing, mm-hmm. and it's understanding that person may be feeling badly about something. Now, we think of empathy as really being able to understand that person's emotions. I don't think that's necessarily true, because again, how do we really know what they're thinking? We might think we know what they're thinking, but we might come from totally different belief systems. So I think what we can do, and we can display empathy simply by communicating to that person that whether or not we do understand exactly how they're feeling, we might have an idea, it might be something relatable, but regardless, that we understand that they're feeling something, and that something is distressing to them,
mm-hmm.
and that we're there to help.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the book, you've laid it out basically into, I guess, six sections, the first section being where you lay out the five principles, and then the other sections where you take each of the five principles and expand upon them, largely through storytelling, like you were saying. And I was thinking maybe for the rest of the interview here, we could touch on a few of those stories.
Sure.
One that you didn't really tell a lot of stories in the book about, but I think it's a really important one, one that a lot of people probably have trouble with, is how to handle somebody who verbally attacks you. That's particularly important when you're dealing with the first principle, and that's where you line it up. But that's a tough one under any circumstance.
Well, it is. And what's interesting about that is the way to handle it best is not to wait until it happens to handle it.
Right.
In other words, you know, we know most of us have what we call a default setting, which I talk about in the book, and that is the natural, instead of response, really it's the natural reaction to mm-hmm. a pressure situation.
Yeah,
and it's typically not very a very positive reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we can do is you know, if we feel that, let's say, certain people we know have a way of pushing our buttons, or certain circumstances push our buttons, then what we want to do is put those in our mind and rehearse a better ending, rehearse the situation. So in other words, we see something like this about to happen, and we can even, by the way, go back into the past and see a situation like that did happen, and then imagine having a different response. Imagine responding in calm, or imagine being serene, thinking about it, responding rather than reacting, and then coming up with a response that's beneficial to the situation. We know that the mind doesn't know the difference between something that actually happened and something that's being suggested to it. So the unconscious doesn't know, the subconscious doesn't know. So now do the same in future situations. Imagine something about to come up, or imagine something coming up in which someone says something to you, does something to you, a circumstance happens, whatever. And now imagine yourself, rather than reacting with a negative or sadness or anger or whatever, imagine yourself just handling it beautifully. You think about it, you frame your response, you don't allow it to bother you, but instead you just and do this again and again and again. Just like an astronaut, and I point this out in the book, you know, an astronaut goes into space, and before they go on their actual mission, they do simulations, hundreds of them maybe, so that by the time they get up into space, when something does go wrong, which it could, they've already been there, they've done that, they're familiar with it. Again, it doesn't matter that it's not totally true. The mind doesn't know, so it's prepared, and it's the same here. Now, I'll just say that when you do this, you're going to probably see pretty quick success. But even if you mess up, don't worry about it because you're human. And we all do it, and I continue to do it. It's not nearly like I used to, but there's times something pushes my button and I allow myself to snap or what have you. Now, can you feel badly about it? A little bit if you want, but don't rack yourself with guilt and say, oh, I can't do this. No, it's like anything else. It takes some practice, but boy, I'll tell you what, once you do it, you really become a different person. You don't become a different person, but you grow into your true, more effective person.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that occurred to me as I was reading that chapter about how to handle attacks, personal attacks, verbal attacks, is that for somebody who's challenged by that, who finds that to be a particularly difficult hurdle to overcome, I can just imagine the reaction might be, well, wait a minute, the verbal attack is his fault. Why do I have to do all this work?
And the answer is that while it seems unfair, it just is what it is. We can't expect the other person to know these things, which is why, you know, we are on our way to huge success in terms of this. Now, let's take some actual language you can use. Let's say you are verbally attacked by someone. Again, you respond to it. You pause a moment. You might even say to this person, you know, I'm wondering, I might owe you an apology. Did I say or do something to offend you?
Wow, now, that's a different way of taking it, isn't it?
Right. And so you've given first an I message. You've put the onus, not the blame, but the onus on yourself. So you've said this is a matter of tact. You've made it very digestible for them and ingestible for them. Okay,
yeah, that's a big difference, too. Onus versus blame.
Blame,
There's a huge difference there.
Exactly. And so this person now doesn't have to be defensive about it. You know, I mean, if you said to this, hey, what are you yelling at me? Well, you're not, right? You know, so what we're going to do is when we respond, we are resetting the frame. We're controlling our emotions. We're resetting the frame. We're acknowledging the ego at stake. Again, the frame set, and now a new frame set. And with tact, we're now, in a sense, calling this person out, but in a very, very tactful way. And then their response is a lot different.
In fact, you kind of carry the theme through when you got to section 3, which talks about your second principle. You return to the same theme about the attacks, and in chapter 16, I like the title of the chapter. You said, personal or not, how do you know?
Yeah, and you don't know. You really don't know because, again, you don't know their belief system. You don't know where they're even coming from. And I think in that chapter I use the example of the person who you acknowledge. You know, you say, hi. And the person just kind of goes, you know,
yeah.
Hey, grunt. And so what do we start doing? We start filling in the blanks based on our own belief system, right? Well, we would never just grunt at someone unless we just didn't like them. So it must be that that person doesn't like us. Now, we've never met that person. Mm-hmm. We know nothing about this person's backstory. We don't know what happened that morning. They just found out their kid got kicked out of school or someone they love is in the hospital or they lost a sale or, you know, we don't know, right? But we fill in the blanks with our story, not theirs.
Right.
And so, you know, we don't know what they're thinking. And, you know, even that person who says something, you know, that sounds harmful, we don't know their belief system and we don't even know what they mean. A great book about this that was written years ago was The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz. And he talks about assumptions and not taking things personally. Those are two of the four agreements. And it sounds very simple, but he does a magnificent job of explaining why this is. And I think he did a great job talking about beliefs. He calls them agreements. I call them belief systems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The thing I like about this chapter in congruence with what you discussed earlier is when you are faced with an attacker, when you're faced with a personal attack, that's when it's the best time to ask, is this really a personal attack? That's basically what you touch on indirectly. Yes, you more directly talked on the person who's more indifferent to that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it also applies as much to the attack situation, because in the attack situation, one of the ways that you get yourself to that place of where you can say, well, geez, did I offend you? If I did, I apologize, is to realize it may not be about you at all.
Right, exactly, and it's often not, but you don't know that, and so that's where we play the mind games with ourselves, and it's never a fun game.
No, it's not. It's a difficult game. But anyway, I've been culling stuff here that I found to be interesting. But I'm sure there's some there are certain pieces of the book, perhaps certain stories that you find to be, you know, the ones that are your favorites, that you enjoyed the most when you wrote them, or perhaps you've gained the most out of them in your own personal experience. Any particular ones that come to mind that you want to share?
I think one with Liberty the cat, who is my stray cat.
All right, tell that story again. That's a good one.
Yeah, well, there's a couple with Liberty. You know, one was when we first found her. It was just, you know, she was my neighbor Terry had said, you know, Bob, there's a cat out there that looks like it's feral, looks like it's starving, and indeed she did look that way, but was so scared of humans that when I got some cat kibble and put it in a plastic bowl and put it out there, she wouldn't go near it until we were far enough away that she didn't feel any threat. She knew she could get away if she had to. But she ate, and she was starving, and I mean, she ate it, and then, you know, every day I'd start doing this and just get it, bring the bowl kind of closer and closer to my back up, patio. Mm-hmm. And she would eat, but, you know, she never felt threatened because she always had an escape route. She always had a back door.
Right.
And eventually I'd, you know, bring the bowl into my patio, but I'd leave the back door open. So she always had a back door. I always
mm-hmm.
had an escape route.
Sure.
Eventually I put the bowl in the home because I was starting to really fall in love with this cat, and I mm-hmm. wanted her to be my cat, and I wanted to be her human. So I wanted to get her used to coming into the house. And she would actually even eat in the house as long as the door was wide open for her.
Mm.
And, you know, eventually I wanted to get her used to being in the closed house. And I began to close the door. But as soon as I did, she looked back as though to run. And so immediately I reopened the door as wide as it would go. And she was fine again. And then eventually when she realized there was absolutely no threat, I could close the door. She'd come in the house at night. She'd hang out and so forth. And then she'd go back out in the patio to sleep. And then she'd, you know, be there for breakfast the next morning, and then, this went on. Now, here's the interesting thing. It's not that she ever wanted to leave. It's that she wanted to know she could leave.
Right.
And the same principle works with two-legged beings as well as four-legged beings.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, most human beings, we just don't want to feel forced or pressured. We
right.
want to know that the decision is ours. I call it Berg's Law of the Out or Back Door, and it simply says the bigger the out or back door you give someone to take, the less they'll feel the need to take it. And we can do that in all sorts of situations, whether it's sales and marketing, whether it's personal, whether it's what have you. We need to make sure that other person understands that they are actually in control of their decision.
Your story is particularly poignant for both Louise and I because this past summer we also rescued some cats.
And
in fact, these were four cats, three originally and then a fourth, who we learned later had been abandoned by a family who lived across the street when they were evicted from their home. Yeah, really kind of a sad situation. What's particularly bizarre about it, I won't get into the whole story, but what's particularly bizarre is that these cats were all fixed at the SPCA under what they call the Capture, Fix, and Release program,
mm-hmm.
which means that the family knew about that program and knew about the humane handling of the SPCA, and yet they didn't take the cats to the SPCA. Still trying to figure that one out.
Yeah, well, and again, that goes back to belief systems.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can't figure it out because you don't know where they came from. You know, we just don't know. But, yeah, it's certainly hard for us, especially animal lovers, to even imagine how anyone could ever hurt an animal, abuse an animal, or just totally not love an animal. But again, we're talking different belief systems.
Right, right. In fact, the only theory we can come up with is they were in serious pain themselves, and they were being evicted from their home.
Yeah.
So they had lots of personal issues going on, and that may have clouded their judgment. As sad as that is, may have clouded their judgment. So anyway, we ended up finding one of them who came up on the lawn, and Louise lured him in and fed him and so forth, and that led us to finding he was a black cat. Then he went away for about 48 hours, and we thought maybe he was gone. So we went to look for him and found him in the driveway across the street, except he was smaller and he had a broken paw.
Aww.
Well, it turned out it was the second cat.
Wow.
Yeah, two black cats. And then there was also a gray cat. And those three we found within like a week of each other. And so we said, okay, well, we're going to try to adopt these guys because, I mean, we only wanted to have maybe one or two cats at some point, not three.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
how do you turn one out, you know? You just can't do it.
Well, thank you. That was very nice of you and Louise to do that.
Well, especially since the gray cat likes to attack the black cats. So they sequester them. The black cats are upstairs. The gray cat stays downstairs. Near the twain shall meet. And then we'd also heard from the people who had moved into that house after the other people had been evicted that there was a fourth cat, but we hadn't seen her. And we did catch sight of her one time, but she just kind of flitted into the shadows. Well, about, 3 weeks ago? I live in Virginia. We live in Virginia. And we had one particular night where the temperature was going to get pretty cold. It was going to get below 20 degrees, so not a nice night for an animal to be out, particularly a domesticated house cat.
Yeah.
And this fourth cat showed up at our back door. We have French doors in the back. Showed up at the back door, basically paws on the door, screaming, "Meow, let me in!" So that became the fourth cat. We figured, okay, now what are we going to do this with this one? We got to keep her away from the gray cat who attacks other cats, but we got to keep her, you know, away from the black cats who don't know her yet. Building these sections in the house. Come to find out, though, the gray cat and the new one, who we call Lady, they actually apparently were previously friends. We didn't know that at first. So
wow.
Once we discovered that, they started eating out of the same dish together. They sleep together. They're always curled up together. They follow each other all over the place. It's like, oh, my God, we helped reunite a family.
Yeah. What a great deed you did.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you never know what's going to come out of applying the basic principles that you like. There it is, this story playing out in a way that nobody would have expected.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Liberty the Cat, that's a great story. How about another one for us?
Let's see. Gosh, there were so many fun stories of things that happened. Some that weren't fun, but were good growth stories.
Talk about a growth story then.
Huh?
Talk about a growth story.
Well, there was the one with the immigration agent in at the Toronto airport who was who was making it very, very difficult for me to get into the country where I had a program I was doing for at a large sales conference, so I really needed to get in. She was finding all sorts of bureaucratic reasons why I couldn't. And she seemed like a very nice person, but there was something that was really, really going on. And I had to really work hard at controlling my emotions and understanding that there were different belief systems at work and making sure to, the whole thing. And of course, within the book, you're going to learn how to do, not to have to think about all of these. These will come naturally once you learn it. It doesn't take long at all, but I had to be able to go through this successfully. And finally, at one point, she asked me if I knew, and she mentioned the name of a popular U.S. speaker. And I said, well, I know of him. And she went into a rant about how rude he was and how this and that. And I realized that was what her problem was. That's what her problem was. She identified me, a speaker, with being some other U.S. speaker. I mean, I'm from the U.S., he's from the U.S., that must make us exactly the same person.
Oh, yeah, so, all those U.S. speakers are alike, you know that.
Yeah, so again, it's belief systems and it's ways of thinking. Logically, does that make sense? No, but emotions aren't necessarily logical. So
that's right.
I had to work within that and had to do it in a way where I didn't put down the other speaker because I wasn't going to gossip, but at the same time, I had to just, let her know how just I appreciate your working with me and your help and getting, and so forth. And it was fine. And she turned out to be a very nice person as I suspected she was. But that was a real growth experience because it could have really made a tough situation very, very difficult and could have resulted in my being sent back, which wouldn't have made my client happy at all.
Yeah, but it turned around after you were
very able
to basically apply the principles that you talk about in the book. The resulting conversation that it ended in was completely different from the one that started.
Yeah, and already in the book's just been out now about a month and a week, I guess, and we're getting such great stories and great feedback from people who are utilizing these principles, and they're just seeing these results, which I knew they would because I've been teaching these for years, and I've gotten lots of letters from people and emails, of course, from more than letters from people who apply these. So, yeah, if someone purchases this book, they will really take their people skills, their ability to influence others in a benevolent way, just through the roof. So very, very excited about it.
That's great. We only have a couple minutes left, but maybe you can draw from what you remember of some of those letters you've gotten in the last month and a half. Any particular letter that stands out for you?
Oh, yeah. Well, let's see. We just got one from a person who had a client situation, not a client situation, it was a supplier that they deal with. And the supplier had been really kind of making things difficult. And we think, well, supplier, but they want your money. They're going to make, well, people can find ways to make things difficult. Mm-hmm. And this person was doing it. It was really based on a misunderstanding that was going on. And so what the, and this person before they read the book had been very much, well, I need to know this, I need to know that, and what is it, in which she realizes she had to approach this an entirely different way. She had to tap into their belief system. She had to tap into their emotions, their ego, their way of doing business, and to find out what it actually was. And when she did, she got a real apology from them, and the service, was back to what it was supposed to be, which helped everyone. So those are just, those are just off-the-cuff letters we get. And, of course, on Amazon.com, we get to see all sorts of nice things.
Yeah, Amazon's great for that, isn't it?
Yeah.
You get all kinds of commentary on that because people utilize it. Yeah. It's one of those common systems people use.
Yeah, and people will tell you what they don't like, too. And,
sure.
And we can always learn from that. But so far, the responses, the feedback has just been great.
Yeah, I guess as an author, you have to have a bit of a thick skin because not everybody's going to like everything that you write.
Well, they won't. But hey, I'm human. So when I see somebody say something that's nasty about it, I certainly it bothers me. I think what bothers me and this would be probably more with the Go Giver, where I'd see comments where I said to myself, did they actually even read the book?
Yeah.
Or were they just commenting on the title? And you feel bad when that happens. But, fortunately, 99% of the feedback is great. And so, hey, people are human. They're going to do what they do.
Well, your previous books have done really well. I mean, last year you told me that your four books had each sold over 250,000 copies. So I have to ask you, are we going to see even better numbers from Adversaries into Allies?
Oh, I think this is going to be my biggest selling book by far.
Really?
Yeah, this is really, I'm so passionate about this message, and it's, it's what I'm really dedicating the rest of my life to, is getting out this message, because I think it's so important. And, and again, it's not that it's about me and my passion about, the reason I'm passionate about it is because it's something that's not only needed, but wanted. People are accepting, and people have accepted, that people's skills have a lot to do with success. Dale Carnegie was saying it way back when. When he said success is about 10% technical skills and 90% people skills. And I think the more technically oriented we get in society today, I think people are really understanding that the difference maker is people skills.
Yeah, I think that's true. And by the way, we alluded earlier to the Go Giver and to your co-author, and you mentioned how he was the real storyteller in all this. But I have to tell you, I think your storytelling skills are improving because you told some good stories in this book.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
I mean, I'm just waiting for the full novel that comes out at some point that basically uses the same approach that you did with the Go Giver, but this time it's all Bob Berg.
Well, if I was going to do that and do a parable, I would beg and plead John to do it with me.
Yeah, I guess you don't want to break up a good team, do you? Well, Bob Berg, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today and tell us about the book. I presume that readers can find it at both Amazon and Barnes & Noble and virtually bookstores anywhere, but are there any other resources they should look at?
Yeah, if they go to burg.com and they click on the icon of the book there, it will take them to a page where they can get chapter one to read it for free, to see if they like it first, to read that chapter to see if they like it. Then they can always click through to any of the online stores or, as you said, go to their local bookseller.
And that's cool because chapter one is the one where you lay out the five principles.
Yeah.
So you can see right from the get-go what it is they're getting into.
Exactly.
That's very good. Bob Berg, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, you're always great. I appreciate you tremendously. My regards to Louise, and I wish all of you a very happy holiday season.
That was Bob Berg from December 2013, and my interview with him about his book, Adversaries into Allies, Master the Art of Ultimate Influence. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody. It might seem crazy what I'm about to say.
happens to you, don't waste your time. Here's why.
Because I'm happy.
Come along if you feel like a room without a roof.
Because I'm happy.
Come along if you feel like happiness is the truth.
Because I'm happy.
Come along if you know what happiness is to you.
Because I'm happy.
Come along if you feel like that's what you want to do.
Because I'm happy.